Lucas Barfield.
And I'm Uncle Dig.
Yeah. Welcome to the Cannabis Corner.
And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How is it going, Uncle Dig?
It is going great today, Lucas. I'm happy to be back. We've had a little bit of a break, but I am excited to get going again.
Yeah, we were on break, and this is our 50th episode. So we just finished up our fifth season. Go over to our blog, thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com, to find that archive. And you can also find all of our other shows on Radio Tacoma, and those will be coming up. And we got season one up on YouTube, too, Dig. I didn't mention that to you on the pre-show. If you go over to YouTube and search The Cannabis Corner, we do have season one up, so you can hear me all the way back when I was recording The Cannabis Corner on my laptop here at this desk with just nothing but me and rambling on about cannabis back in 2017. So go over there and check that out. My plan is to get all those up on YouTube. Matter of fact, tomorrow I'm turning season two into MP4s and getting those up. This is just a two-man operation, you guys. So we move kind of slow here at The Cannabis Corner, but that is all good. So, like you said, really happy to be back on the air with you, Dig.
Yeah, I'm having fun. I know that you've been ill with something, right, recently that you wanted to talk about a little bit.
Oh, man, I tell you what, I have not put this on Facebook or social media anywhere just because that is a little more, I don't know. I don't want Mark Zuckerberg to be following my health issues, but I came down with the dreaded COVID, Dig.
And you finally got it.
Yeah, and I actually got it out and about doing a cannabis event, networking. I was doing good work when I was out, and I got the COVID. And man, let me tell you, I actually beat COVID. I was like, screw you, COVID. But in order for me to do that, it basically zapped me so bad. I had actually been training for a half marathon. So the day after I got COVID, I was out running 800s, and I ran a 358 800. And I was ready to go. I had been running, like, doing hour runs and all this stuff. I got COVID, did the runs, and then the next day had, like, a little bit of a fever, and then it just got worse. I broke the fever in, like, 3 days with the help of THC, a lot of CBD, and a lot of CBG. You know, I fought back COVID, but, man, it just took all that training. Literally, a whole summer's worth of training and just sucked it right out of me.
Oh, so your cardio's back to baseline or even worse.
Yeah, my cardio, fatigue, everything. I was running this past Sunday, and I'm back to just doing turns and straightaways as far as my running goes. I mean, I'm not into doing 400s. Get me to run a mile, I don't even know if I could do it right now. So I'm still recovering. But it's incredible how hard that is on your body. And I can see if you were sick or if you were older, how it would be very bad for you. And so I'm very lucky and very grateful that I was able to get through that.
Well, I'm glad it just turned into a training hiccup and not something more serious, man.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And I'm very thankful, too, that we were able that people in my family, only one other person did get it. And so we were able to dodge that situation. So I am very grateful and very lucky to be able to get through that. And so COVID is COVID's real, y'all. I don't know if you know that. People say it's not. So last time we talked, you, Dig, you were bringing in your harvester, getting ready to do that. Whatever happened with that? How is that going?
Well, it went good. So everything's in. I took my last two little tiny experimental autoflowers in last night because it's not going to get above 50 degrees anymore in my area. And so when it's below 50 degrees all the time, cannabis doesn't really grow much. So I went ahead and cut them really early. So they're probably in mid-flower. So they're probably going to be a little like weird and not that good to smoke. But they were always an experiment. They turned into little bonsais. They were very pretty. And then I ended up getting some decent yields off of some of my plants that had mites just because they were so big. So that was good, and all my plants are in, all my plants are drying or have been dried and put into jars. So my 2022 outdoor season is completely done, and the only thing I have left is two little indoor plants in a micro grow, and that's it. So I am down to two plants.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations on bringing in a pretty good harvest. My harvest outdoors was terrible. The June rainy season up here really messed me up. And I'm just now getting my little measly indoor garden kind of going back again, too. So the outdoor, I went up. We're going to have a guest on to talk about this soon. But I went up to a hemp farm, too, over the break.
Okay.
And, man, the hemp plants that would usually be above your head, there was not one that was above shoulder height.
Yeah, I've been hearing some mixed reports that some people didn't have a good year this year. I had a rough year this year. Some people had a rough year, but I also know of some people that seem to do pretty well. But I only know one person personally that had a really large yield without too many issues. And that may have changed. I haven't talked to him in a while. My friend Roland Smokes has looked like he was doing really well this year. I don't know if he's pulled or not. I assume he has. But I've had a couple other friends that I've been out who haven't had as large plants as they're accustomed to, either just due to like some labor issues, or like I said, weather. And the weather was weird out here in the Northwest. Normally June is a dry month, and here, down here in Southern Oregon, as well as up there in Tacoma, it was rainy in June, and it really affected the plants' growth patterns in really interesting ways.
Yeah, I learned a little bit. Cannabis plants do not like to get put out in mid-June. They want to get that, whatever's going on with the sun as far as the days getting longer in May. That's what they like. If you put it in, it's not just cannabis plants. I tried to plant my pumpkins in mid-June too, and they did not work. So yeah. I learned a little bit. I'm still, being from the South, you can put a seed in the ground, it's just going to grow because it's hot as heck, and you can keep the bugs off of it, it's going to grow. So I've never really had problems growing gardens before, but here I'm still learning a lot about the Northwest climate and learning a lot every year. But we're going to move on to our stories. But before we get to that, we have a great guest segment coming up, and that is one of our Cannabis Corner correspondents, Henry Hagen of the Henry Hagen Band. Check that out online if you get a chance. Went up to Seattle earlier this year and did some recordings at a Hemp Fest fundraiser, and so we have that audio ready to go, and we have some people on the scene here in Seattle telling us all about Hemp Fest, what it is, what it means to them, where Hemp Fest is now, and where Hemp Fest is going. And so stay tuned for that in our guest segment.
Awesome.
And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa special report.
So now let's get on to our very first story. And this story is a story that we would never want to bring on the Cannabis Corner. And that is that a kid, died allegedly of Delta-8 THC toxicity. Now, I say allegedly because there still is some investigations going on. They don't know what exactly happened as far as how much he ate, or whether it was the THC that ended his life, or whether it was toxicity related to the Delta-8. Because as we've mentioned on the show, when you make Delta-8, they are using crazy chemicals. And apparently, from what I've heard on WSLCB Zoom calls back about 2 years ago, when you make Delta-8, there's a sludge left over that they don't even know how to test for that. So if that gets into some of your gummies or something, you eat those, that's going to be big problems. You did some more reading up on this story, Dig. We don't really want to go on about this too much as far as making any kind of point, because like I said, there is an investigation, and a kid did die, and a mother is in jail. So it's a very terrible and sad story. What were some of your observations that you saw here?
Basically, I don't want to spend too much time on this. Like you said, it's very tragic when a young person dies, especially someone this young. He's a young child. It's like 4 or 5, I think. However, like you said, because of the nature of the boy's death and how his mother interacted with law enforcement and the way the Virginia laws are written, they have arrested her for felony murder and felony child neglect. She is in jail. Her arraignment is set for November 1st. I think for more details of this case to come out, it will probably have to go to trial. I really I don't want to say mistrust, but the sources of information are incomplete at this time. So I don't really know what to think here other than a child died and he had some form of THC in his system and that those two things happened. I don't know if they're connected, but I do find it interesting that the police arrested this mother for the death of this child. And I think that while it's tragic, it would be interesting to see the state try to prove that THC was the mode of the child's death, if that makes sense.
Yes, it will be interesting to see what the lab reports do say, because we, as they mentioned, the chemicals in the Delta 8 and what else may have been going on with the child. But we just want to repeat again, public service announcement here on the Cannabis Corner. And I taught this in my class I taught over at TCC, and I will tell it to parents all the time. Please keep your cannabis edibles away from your kids. Any kind of cannabis product, flower, dabs, whatever it is. If you have young kids in your house, you make sure it's all locked up.
This is, and this honestly, if you're a rural person, if you're like for instance a gun owner, this is really easy. Just put your jar of cannabis on a shelf separate in your gun safe that's not with your other guns, and that way it's all locked up with your other stuff that can hurt your kids, and it's all safe, and you can grab it, but the child can't. Lock it up, please.
Yeah, lock it up. Put it on a high shelf. Hiding doesn't necessarily work, but at least hide your stuff away. Don't just leave your edibles sitting on a table. Because a kid or pets too. There's lots of stories out there. Pets eating a cookie and having big problems.
A cannabis edible will kill your dog.
And other adults eating edibles that they don't know are THC edibles. Because I've really learned since I started using a vaporizer, like a Mighty vaporizer, that has like these little medical caps. And you only put 0.15 grams in those things. THC is an extremely powerful substance, because you can just put a little tiny bit of cannabis in a vaporizer and smoke it, and you will get, it's very powerful. So again, parents, and when it's in edible form, it's going to soak in or absorb into the system more, and it's going to stay in your system longer. So just make sure you're keeping all your stuff locked up and put away.
Yeah.
So moving on to the next story, this is a report by Leafly, and this is the second annual Leafly Harvest Review Report, and it found that cannabis is the sixth largest crop in the United States. The adult use cannabis market is worth $5 billion, and they almost grew 2,500 metric tons of cannabis last year. And I know that sounds like a lot, folks.
So that means we're only 24%. Toward meeting the demand legally. That's basically what the article says. So for reference, cannabis comes in at about a $5 billion worth legal crop domestically. Comparing that to the fifth most money producing crop in America, cotton, at $7.5 billion. The cannabis industry is a large share of market share of agriculture, and that doesn't look to change. So look for more corporate investment in cannabis, not less.
Yeah, and the report does go a long way to point out that there are big problems in the cannabis industry as far as pricing goes, and that in the West, cannabis prices are falling, and in the East, cannabis prices are going up, and that's because cannabis growers in the West produce too much. Back East, they can't produce enough. But guess what, Dig? We live in this crazy United States where you can make money on a thing, but it's still illegal. So then they throw in the illicit market, and this whole big whirlwind of issues that are going on right now in the cannabis industry. And I just saw today, Oregon farmers are cutting back on their growing. Humboldt County farmers in California, Dig, are like begging the government to help them out. They just suspended a tax on Humboldt County cannabis growers because there's so much problem with low prices. Nobody's buying it.
Yeah.
Just imagine that, good dig. Humboldt County cannabis. Nobody can buy it.
So, folks, here's the thing. Craft cannabis, we're talking about gardens that have what? Let's make it arbitrary. Like, let's say less than 100 plants. Is that fair to call that craft,
100,
Lucas?
100.
Yeah. So less than 100 plants. This is some of the best cannabis flower you're going to find. It's some of the closest thing you're going to find to something I would grow in my backyard or one of my friends would grow in their yard. Really, really good cannabis. Pretty soon, if the market keeps going and we keep having these giant tanks in the price of wholesale flower that's from the farmer wholesale per pound, and it drops, like I've seen it as low as $200 a pound. I've seen it as high as $3,000 a pound in my time, you know, just around cannabis. And when it drops below $600, $500 a pound, these craft farmers can't make a living and they can't produce this really, really fine cannabis at the scale that people would like. And so they're just priced out of the market. They can't grow enough to support their operation. They go out of business because the price drops so low. They can't get enough money for the amount of work they put in and the amount of resources they put in. So pretty soon, if the market continues the way it is, the only way you're going to be able to get craft cannabis is by growing it yourself or becoming friends with someone who grows a small craft grow on their land. And that's sad. But I would highly encourage you to pick up the skill of growing cannabis now rather than wait until there's a drought on really good cannabis and all you can find is mids and stuff like that.
Yeah, it is a real big problem. It is the sixth largest crop, but you know, it's kind of looking like it's going to be the sixth largest crop with like a race to the bottom where it's kind of all the same kind of cannabis you can buy when but you know, they will have some good, really good stuff, but it's going to be very expensive and very hard to get. Like, and they were pointing out, like, back east in Illinois, Michigan, cannabis growers are doing fine because it's
$80
so expensive.
An eighth.
Yeah, it's so expensive, they're able to make money off of it. I mean, I think 40 an eighth is reasonable, things like that. I mean, where I'm from, quarters used to be $40. So I'm used to paying $100 an ounce. I don't think anything less than that is reasonable for cannabis. But, you know, really good cannabis, $200 an ounce, I totally think that's reasonable. But with our crisis of capitalism, which we're going through right now, oversupply, under demand.
You can grow good high-grade cannabis in your backyard with the right approach for $2 a gram.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, 2 cents a gram. You can grow it for 2 cents a gram.
Yeah.
My first garden, I grew two plants. I yielded 1.08 pounds off of those two plants.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing. And every beautiful bud that came off that plant cost me 2 cents.
Well, that's really cool you calculated that up. And so home growing is the solution.
That's outdoor. Indoor is way more expensive to produce.
Yeah, the indoor is going to be way more, and it's a little more difficult too. But,
yes.
You know, it's interesting where this is going. I think everybody's compared cannabis to alcohol enough that we can see where this might be going, where it's like you got so-so alcohol and good alcohol, and it depends on how much money, what you can get, where you can get it. So we'll see what happens with that. Go over there and check out the Leafly Report. And now we're going to move on to another thing about cannabis market growing, and that is down in Florida, which they have medical cannabis down there, and it's some amazing stats coming out of Florida. Their patient count grew by 25%. They're up over, I think, 750,000 patients in Florida. By the way, Washington has under 10,000 registered patients. Florida has 750,000. Another stat out of Florida that was really incredible is they sold 546 million ounces of cannabis, and 540 million of those ounces were smokable cannabis.
Nice. So, the Florida market, this is one of those things where I was wrong. But I was wrong about people being able to produce high-grade cannabis at scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
They keep proving me that big operations can't grow as good a cannabis as small operations. I was wrong. I thought they would be able to, so I was wrong. And I was also wrong about Florida. Florida's market seems to be doing really well. They seem to have overcome some of their initial hurdles, and I'm really impressed. I really am.
Yeah, and there's another story I just want to mention. They rumor, not rumored, they might start selling cannabis at Circle K gas stations in Florida. Green Thumb Industries put on a Green Thumb Industries and Circle K came to a deal. Now the regulators kind of put a pause on it, but I really think this is coming through.
And oh wow!
Let me tell you something. I went to college in Florida, and there was a Circle K right at the end of where I went to school, and it would have been much better if I could have went there and got medical cannabis than all the beer we went and got. So I think this is great for medical cannabis access to put it into Circle K's. Now, of course, you want to have 21 and older, no kids in, and make sure you keep everything locked up tight for that. But for me, the more cannabis you can get in front of people, the better, especially when we have the opiate crisis, we have an addiction crisis, mental health crisis, all these things going on. I think it's a good thing coming out of Florida. We'll see what happens with that Circle K thing. We'll keep an eye on that.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to hear what happens with that.
And so the next story we're going to stay down south is, and that's a real quick update on the Mississippi medical cannabis industry. And we've been covering this since it passed. From the beginning, they had a lawsuit. They had all these court battles. And finally, Mississippi is getting medical cannabis. But they say it's going to come out in January, but they just have 400 patients registered over the whole state. And then you have some statistics on how many dispensaries and other things they have going on there in Mississippi.
Yeah. So the Mississippi officials had a press briefing last week, and they had issued provisional licenses to 138 dispensaries, 47 cultivators, 8 processors, 4 transportation entities, 3 state-mandated disposal companies, which, 2 testing labs, and 491 work permits, people certified as legally cleared to work in cannabis. Let me explain why I said ew to 3 state-mandated disposal companies, these state-mandated disposal companies. So basically, this is a way to add regulation around cannabis trash where there really doesn't need to be. So in a lot of states, they say that any leaf that you pluck off the plant has to be disposed of a certain way, which is dumb because a lot of times it keeps you from composting your leaves, which is a good way to return nutrients to the soil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a way to needlessly regulate cannabis byproducts that aren't even dangerous. That's why I said ew. However, there's also been 491 work permits in this industry. So this is a pretty they're planning on having more than 406 state-approved patients with 138 dispensaries, okay? Mm-hmm. So they're getting their infrastructure ready, and it looks like in the next couple of years, there's going to be a boom in Mississippi, just judging by the amount of dispensaries they're starting.
Yeah, I thought compared to what was the other statistics there, I thought the dispensary number was pretty high there. And so they're planning on having more. Just being from the South, I'm guessing that low number is still a little distrust of the system. People aren't really comfortable. I always compare it to like putting your head inside the mouth of an alligator. You just never know what's going to happen.
And hey, so, buddy.
Yeah. So that's kind of how people feel, I think. But like in my home state right next door in Alabama, they are actually starting to roll out cities are starting to discuss bans and whether they're going to have cannabis. They did it kind of differently there. They asked people who wants an application, and then they sent it out an email. And I actually have one person from my hometown that is going to get a cannabis or try to get a cannabis license in Alabama for transportation. He hit me up and was like, hey, what do you think I should do? And I said, hey, well, you're a trucker now, so it sounds like you'd be great if you apply for a transportation license.
You might not even need a truck at first. He might only need a van.
Yeah,
a lot of the transport that was going on in the legal market up and down the 5 just here in Oregon that was legal. We're not talking people going down to Cali to grab a bag or whatever. We're literally talking about legal transport was done in panel vans, dude, because there just wasn't like sometimes there's not that much. Like a lot of times there's a lot when you're talking about loose flower. Mm-hmm. But if you're transporting like cartridges of cannabis oil, you don't need a truck.
Yeah. Well, he has a CDL and he's used to driving, you know what I mean? So that I just feel like getting into the growing space, the processing space, and even the retail space, I mean, you got to already be like an expert and already knee deep into the industry at that point.
Yeah.
He was not there. He's just a truck driver. And it's really great. And congratulations to him for getting that going. And it's really neat. And I hope that that works out in Alabama. They don't have smokable cannabis. So, but, you know, like states like Louisiana that eventually came on. So there is stuff moving around down south in cannabis. And actually, Missouri and Arkansas have ballot initiatives coming up. So we'll be updating the audience on that. So that is an update on some cannabis legalization there. And now let's get on to our Hemp Fest audio taken by Henry Hagen back around 420. This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by the Hemp for Hunger Food Drive. Learn more about this event at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
But I have a couple questions, and they are, what does Hemp Fest mean to you?
Well, Hemp Fest means to me the world's largest annual cannabis policy reform event, the America's largest free speech event. But really, you know, it's about truth in the face of lies. It's about freedom in the face of oppression. And it's about the power of community volunteerism and what, you know, a large group of people will do for a cause they believe in. You know, I've been taught by Hemp Fest that people will work longer and harder for something they believe in than for any amount of money. And so really, you know, it's about speaking truth to power and speaking flower to power.
Yeah, I love it. All right, what did you miss about Hemp Fest after the pandemic?
Oh.
Or during the pandemic?
Wow, that's a big subject there, man. Well, you know, to be honest, I guess the number one thing that I missed is our opportunity to speak to tens of thousands of people about the fact that prohibition is still going on. You know, you can go buy an ounce of weed at a store in Washington State and in, you know, dozens of other states, but there's still people in jails and prisons. There's still 40,000 Americans in jails and prisons for cannabis. There's about 25 people serving life in prison for cannabis. As we're doing this right now, somebody has that red light behind their car in some state that's not legal, and you know, somebody's losing their kids, custody of their children, somebody's hearing that clank behind them, somebody's not getting a job or an apartment that they need because they have a felony conviction. So the number one thing I miss is our ability to get the message out, because that's what Hemp Fest has always primarily been about. But then on a personal level, I miss the tens of thousands of Canna family. You know, the 100,000 Canna family that comes to down in the park and basically does two things: celebrates the victories that we've had and protests against the laws that still need to be changed.
So what's the next big thing Hemp Fest can help the cannabis movement with?
Oh man. Well, we've had a brutal last couple of years, you know.
I understand that.
In 2020, because of the pandemic, the plug got pulled on Hemp Fest about a little over 2 months before the event. And, you know, it cost $750,000 to produce that event, and we work on it all year long. And so we had already spent a lot of money, and it put us about $120,000 in the hole. And the thing about Hemp Fest is it's never been a corporately sponsored event. You know, it's literally grassroots to our ass roots, man. The most grassroots event around. It's free to attend. We can't charge any money or we'll lose our constitutional First Amendment status, and they won't give us a permit, right? And that's why it happens on public property. And so, you know, we've always just been barely making it. You know, we've been, well, let me back up. About 5 years ago, the state legislature passed this law banning advertisement by 520 businesses, by rec stores and cannabis businesses in Washington State. It banned their ability to advertise at events like Hemp Fest. And that cost us about $175,000, like bam, just like that, in sponsorship money, right?
Bruh.
Advertising sponsorship.
Bruh.
And so since that time, we were operating on a 2% profit margin. And so now, not only are we $120,000 in the hole, but there's these insane supply chain issues. Everything's gone up. It's not really inflation. It's price gouging is what's really going on. But, I mean, we're just facing so many challenges. Our staff We fill 700 staff shirts during the event. But we have a core staff of 100 people that are meeting every month for the last 23 years. It's been brutal on our staff as well. We've lost some like key people that had been with HempFest for like 10 or 15 years, you know, partially just because of the pandemic and other aspects. So we're really facing some challenges, which is what this show is about tonight, right? And there's another thing I want to talk about. You know, HempFest, our number one goal at every HempFest is there's something more important than legalizing cannabis, and that is nobody gets hurt, right? We've been a safety-first event like no other pot event I know in the world, to the point where we've got extra heart defibrillators that we rent stationed throughout the event in various places because it's so long and narrow. If somebody had a heart attack, our first aid crew wouldn't be able to get to them at 420. It's too packed on the on the path. So we've got heart defibrillators at various stages throughout the event. It's 1.3 miles long and narrow, as you know. We got stop the bleed kits on all of our stages. So if anybody has, you know, some kind of a serious bleeding wound, we've got actual kits there to stop it. I mean, we've done so many safety first things. And when you're talking about a hemp fest, people are going to be sharing from their mouths no matter what we do.
Yep.
And in a pandemic, that's like the worst case scenario. You know, at a normal event, nobody says, "Hey, who wants to drag off my cigarette? Who wants to drink off my straw? Hey, guys, want to eat off my fork?" You know, it just doesn't happen. But at a hemp fest, we know that no matter what we do or say, there's going to be thousands of people probably sharing pipes and joints among themselves. So it makes it even more critical for us that we have to know that the pandemic is really over before we can really responsibly hold the event, you know?
I totally get that. And I'm one of those people that smoke weed. Like, hey, come join the circle.
We don't want to be a super spreader event and get people killed
that's not okay.
Right? So, you know, our goal has always been like to be the Eagle Scouts of the cannabis movement, man, and just have everything wired and be on top of everything. And that's why I think we've been able to pull off, you know, 28 events with 100,000 people with 700 volunteer staff and never had a serious injury, accident, or arrest at the event in all that time, which is kind of a small miracle.
Yeah.
But it shows that we've just been really detail-oriented, right, and really trying to be responsible and professional. You know, we have our own safety patrol. We have 100 trained safety patrol. That's our internal security. They have the radios and shirts and hats and all that stuff. And we've got it so down that the last, I don't know, 8 or 9 years of HempFest, the police don't come in unless we ask for them. You know, they're right outside. They have a command center. They've got our radio there. You know, we've got them on our cell phones. You know, they got our numbers. We have a great relationship with the cops. We actually meet at the West Precinct before the event to go over various safety protocols and emergency evacuation stuff and things like that, which is really wild. You know, I don't think any of the pot rally in the world does that, you know. It's a long answer to a really simple question.
No,
I don't really know. I mean, this is the first thing that we've done since we got shut down, and we've got our sights set on 2023, and we really would like to produce a 2023 Seattle Hemp Fest. I mean, this is the third year of No Hemp Fest. But it's going to take more community buy-in and more community participation than we've had in the past.
What does Hemp Fest mean to you?
I'm actually super excited about this because I've been reading the Everybody Loves Our Town, the biography about Seattle and grunge by Mark Yarm. And so
yes,
it's like reading about the Melvins and U-Men, like how HempFest was in the early 90s. And,
yes,
and being
at Gasworks.
Yes, and being able to be a part of that history and raising money for HempFest and for everything that it's meant over the past few decades is really special.
Yeah.
What is HempFest?
And for me, I grew up here. I'm from Seattle. I'm actually in high school. I've had a lot of friends go to prison and go to jail for possession of cannabis. And to me, it's just like there's so much activism that happens with other things that are important in the world. And just to know that like something as simple as cannabis that actually helps a lot of people in a lot of different ways, the government's so easy to just neglect that.
Yes.
And they just want to neglect like who's been helped, and they just want to focus on like, no, this is a drug, it's bad, and they just want to like classify it. They just like immediately want to like, where can we like get our government to like
actually help
people? Yeah, government wants to hurt people. The people want to help people, and that's when I That's why it's so important to me, because I'm just like, I want to be part of the part that where people help people. Yeah. I'm not part of the whole government once I heard
that's,
of it.
That's actually a good segue to the next question down below, but it'd be like, what's the next big thing that HempFest can do for the cannabis movement?
I think it's doing a great job now, like having different organizations here as part of the benefit and being introduced to new people who are working to help to free people from prison who were arrested and put into prison like for life sentences for just possession of cannabis.
I found out there's 25 of them in Washington State.
Yeah, isn't that insane?
There's a man out here right now that at the showcase, a crocodile, he's out there.
That's what they're saying.
He just released and I cannot believe it. And
an interview with him.
For me though, I think that it's just not because it's so legal like now in Washington, like when you look at like a news channel in any other state, like whether you're in Texas, you're in Minnesota or Idaho, everyone's just like, oh, it's Seattle. They're like, they're the drug capital of the world. They already have a homeless problem. And I'm like, that's not the point. I was like, everyone's so eager to group everything into like a singular problem. It goes so beyond that. I'm like, no, I was like, this is a different thing. And you can literally, we can fix this at a local level, but it's when you get to that federal level, like what they're talking about here on the speakers, like at a federal level, they're like, no, can't do that because.
I mean, it's the industrial complex now too. They're making money from people in prison.
And they don't want to give that to the people.
And especially when weed becomes legal, you know, we're dealing with the repercussions of how many people have already been in prison for cannabis. And so it's legal now in Washington, but we still are dealing with the fact that so many marginalized people were unfairly put in prison for possession. And so I think that that's a huge part of HempFest is like raising awareness of the fact that there are still so many people who need to be helped for
and,
something that
and
is
just
legal
not giving
now.
Up. Like that's like this thing right now. Like we were asked to do this benefit, and they're like this. And my friend Jess Terzansky, she's on the board, and she asked me. She's like, "Do you want to play for HempFest?" And I'm like, "Wait, what? Wait, is this, like, am I playing for at HempFest?" And she's like, "No, there won't be a HempFest if we can't get enough money to put on HempFest." And I go, "Oh," I was like, "Wait, where are we playing?" And she goes, "This is the Crocodile. It's a benefit to raise money for HempFest."
For 2023.
I go,
absolutely.
I did an interview with Vivian, and he was just like, "It's not this year."
I really hope for
2023. Me too. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think what the next process is just to not give up. They need to keep doing things like this, even with quarantine, because so many businesses have faded away. It's important that HempFest doesn't fade away.
So I have a few questions.
Okay.
What does HempFest mean to you?
Oh, man, that's an incredible question. What does HempFest mean to Levi Lyon? I mean, it's turned into just an incredible family and a way of life, and there's a huge fight and huge battle that's been going on for 30 plus years at HempFest. I joined on in like maybe the second half in 2005, so there's certainly some huge warriors and Vivian, of course, got to work on the entertainment committee with Vivian for quite a few years, I guess all the years, along with Jim Matheson, right? He's kind of like my HempFest dad, man. He was the guy that met me down at the park after the interview and showed me where all the stages were going to be and described that, we're going to be booking 100 bands every year on all these multiple stages and that my role, I'd be in charge of getting the bands to and from and finding out what bands are going to play each year. We had 500-600 bands every year submitting to play this festival. Yeah. And so it would take us, 9 months or so just to get through, 50, 60, 70 bands and until our ears bled with music. And then, we come back, a few weeks later, a month later and hammer out another session of bands. And that's how we picked out all the bands for the festival. So that was kind of my introduction. And it's since then, that's all I know, I guess. I mean, we're out on the road doing the Highway to HempFest tours and been helping out with the licensing agreements and other parts of the country and other parts of the world even. So, there's a lot of work to be done. That's why I keep saying.
All right. Well, what's the next big thing HempFest can help the cannabis movement with? Next big thing that cannabis, HempFest can help with the cannabis movement.
What can HempFest do to help with the cannabis movement next?
In your opinion.
Yeah,
I've been asking everybody the same question.
I think just to continue the fight. I think I've said a couple times tonight, man, this is like our We're driving the stake into the ground, and we're catching our second wind. We've had a couple years to catch our breath, and I think that there's just there's a new energy, and soon as all the other parts of the country legalize, there will be a new synergy where we can again we can pick back up the Highway to Hemp Fest tours and make more connectivity and of course just you know not be in so much of a hurry. I know everyone's eager and everyone's in a hurry to legalize, but let's do it on our terms, right? And let's do it smart, you know, and really consider the people's especially the medical patients, right? Not get so eager to recreationally legal that we forget about the real reason why we're doing it, and that's for our freedoms and our rights. So we need to when we legalize, we need to do it right. So I think that's understanding that, and then catching our second wind here and giving it another 30 years. Let's do this. Woo!
What does HempFest mean to you?
Oh gosh, so going back, I grew up in Arizona, and you know, in the 90s, Seattle
was
the place to be. Yeah, and Seattle was so cool, and HempFest was a part of that. So I've got a little of the kind of younger fangirl vibe about it. And then now that I'm working in the industry and with folks, HempFest is the heartbeat. It's the reason we're here in the first place. It's all of those years of activism. And I'm just always so grateful for the work that everybody at HempFest has done and continues to do. And I'm really excited about the future that HempFest has in front of it as well.
What do you do for HempFest? Or what do you do individually?
Yeah, so the Cannabis Alliance is an industry organization here in Washington State. And so we're sort of side by side with HempFest, right? So the work that HempFest does helps us do our work. And what we do, I hope, honors what HempFest has set a foundation for. We do a lot of work around policy in particular, but also community outreach and just making sure our industry is the best it possibly can be.
Yeah, I saw you up on the panel. You three were doing great. What is the next big thing HempFest can do to help the cannabis movement?
Honestly, I think the focus that they have really started to double down on, which is the huge number of folks who are still incarcerated, particularly for cannabis infractions, that need to just be let go. And I see HempFest leaning into that, and I think that that's an excellent place for them to be.
What does HempFest mean to you?
Understanding why cannabis is needed in this industry, in this reality. It's understanding all the fundamental basics that have been denied the public for the sake of corporate greed.
Any social media you would like to shout out?
Yeah. Basically, I'm doing some glass blowing. So you can also find me at Ginger Snap Glass on Instagram. That's just Ginger, G-I-N-G-E-R, Snap Glass. But yeah, shout out to HempFest, you know what I'm saying? It's as long as people are still doing time and the information is still being denied, until it's federally legal, we still need to be paneling. We still need to be, you know what I'm saying, boots in the ground and putting on demonstrations and protestivals, and the whole purpose of why HempFest started in the beginning.
Definitely was a life-changing experience, and getting involved in it, you know, feeling like you have a small part in something that's huge. I mean, you know, the folks at Seattle HempFest have done a lot towards the current state of legal, I call it legalization, because it's not really full on legal, but it's way better than we used to have. You know, I mean, the only reason I ever really was afraid of cops was because I was always holding weed, you know, and now it's not like that. And so, HempFest has been a very satisfying part of my life. And every year down there, Hemposium, it's like a big family reunion. And
I love
it's
that.
It's just been so cool.
What did you miss about HempFest the last couple years?
That there wasn't a HempFest?
Yeah, me too, man. Me too.
2020, maybe 20, yeah, 2020. I was driving along the waterfront in late August, the weekend we should have been in there setting up the event. And it was really sad because I've been going down to Gas or to Myrtle Edwards Park since the first one down there, and then to having been doing Hemposium for, at that point in time, you know, we 2019 was the last year, so we've been doing that for 20 years. It was really weird not to be doing that, because that pretty much was how I spent my summer vacation. I used to go fishing in August, and then, you know, 1999 or so, all of a sudden, nah, it's Hempfest.
There's nothing wrong with that, man. That's pretty much what I do. I go there all the time.
You know, besides the activism, when you get to work a stage, I mean, my heroes are the garbage people, the folks that pick up the trash.
For real.
The people that, yeah, bust their humps all the time. We've got glam jobs at a stage, you know, but it's a lot of it.
Especially
is,
in, like, right? So hot,
yeah. But they run away and join the circus for a week every year. You know, what kid would want to do that?
No.
Yeah.
What is the next big thing Hempfest can help with the cannabis movement? Or what you can do to help the cannabis movement?
Well, actually, I would say what all your listeners can do.
There you go, even better.
Is
shout out KTQA.
Yeah, there you go. Write your congresspeople. Write Maria Cantwell. Tell her about the Moore Act and that we need federal legalization. The thing about activism right now, what I have seen personally is a dropping off of people engaging in cannabis activism. A lot of people think, hey, there's nothing to do anymore. I can go to a store on a Wednesday night at 11 o'clock and have a choice of 100 different products, so why should I give a shit about anything else? You know, the thing is, there are a lot of things left to do. Banking for the stores, so the stores aren't getting robbed so much. You know, heck, we've had over 50 robberies this year.
Yeah,
there's been kids getting shot. Somebody's been murdered. You know, a lot of bad stuff, and that's just because they can't take credit cards. And so there's, you know, the people that are left doing activism, the folks in Olympia, see them all the time. And so it makes it easier for them to dismiss those people if they're the only people showing up. So what people need to do, because right now, who knows when we're going to have another Seattle Hemp Fest, but in the meantime, people need to get involved. They need to go to Olympia, look at the Cannabis Alliance. They're a great group. They can tell you when they have their lobby days and stuff, but you need to just go out and get involved and start speaking out. We need home grow. We need better things for patients, you know. Why can't patients have co-ops and have farmers markets and stuff? Yeah. You know, there's so much left to do. And so we need everybody that's just comfortable going and buying their stuff for their vape pen or, you know, getting their flower or whatever at the store to, you know, keep going to the store, but continue to be involved because you're the people that this is really for. You're the cannabis consumers.
And so the first question is, what does Hempfest mean to you? And we can go around the room. And anytime, chime in. I just did a group, and everybody was kind of chiming in, so it doesn't matter if you're going.
I'll let you go first, Jack. Man, I used to sneak out of school with my friends and just, like, we were all stoners back then, so I would just kind of, like, hang out back then. I mean, I still am, but I'm here performing. I just remember sneaking out with all my friends, and it was kind of just, like, it felt like, I don't know, because we all smoked it, but nobody, like, welcomed the smoking culture, like, the weed culture, until I actually went to Hempfest, and it's like, damn, there's a bunch of people that are just, like, advocating for weed and cannabis over here. It's like, I've never felt this kind of experience, you know, being young, but, you know, it's crazy because there's a lot of youth that are, you know, using cannabis recreationally, like, from the black market anyway, and it's funny because a lot of them are self-medicating for, like, mental illnesses and stuff like that too, yeah. So it's cool to have a resource that's open to not just 21 plus people, to anybody that's actually participating in the community, whether or not it's legal or not for them. They can still come and, you know, have resources to, you know, learn about what they're partaking in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the biggest thing of why I like Hempfest too, is it's like, it kind of opens up the conversation. I mean, music has always been a really integral part in, like, sharing information because it's been a very powerful tool in actually bringing people together. And then once you do get people together, having those real talks, especially related to weed and everything around it, like, even though the business side, like, how it blossoms as an industry,
yeah,
it's regulation, like, all of that, it's a
very health.
Yeah, exactly. And I think just, like, you know, regardless if people do smoke, don't smoke, whatever, I think that there is so much related to, especially just, like, the history of the war on drugs and how black and brown people have been improperly incarcerated for stuff that, like, you know, we're selling every day now, like it's a grocery store item. So I think just like the reason why I really enjoy Hempfest especially is there's also that focus on like what this actually means in a real world sense. It's not just a party of a bunch of stoners getting together and things like that.
No, it's great.
And there definitely is that, but I think like the things that I'm always excited to see is like people actually doing the hard work and thinking through like how we not just make this sustainable, but also like visualize justice within that too. Of like, you know, especially since it's a blossoming business, I'm always stoked to hear like about how different people are looking at that business and where that money is going and how to allocate it properly and all of that, because that has to be part of the conversation. We're gonna be here rocking it anyway.
What does Hempfest mean to you?
Oh, you know, I came from the medical days. Some of you will know me as Dr. Lathrop from the AW Clinic, Advanced Listing.
Yes, I had my clinic too.
Were you at the AW Clinic?
Over in Gig Harbor.
Okay, so way back in 2010, we founded the AW Clinic, and I was one of the providers, you know, giving out the authorizations. And then I ended up sort of winning the lottery for that first license that we opened up.
I remember that.
With that, they changed the law, and actually there were some issues with being a provider, writing authorizations, and having a cannabis shop. So I ultimately had to close the clinic, which was really sad for me. I guess your question was about Hempfest, and I got
to
get into that.
Hey, it's
but
all right.
Because, you know, way back then, I was very involved in Hempfest as a medical doctor and medical provider for cannabis, and it's been Hempfest has really been one of the most important organizations here in Seattle for the last 25 years.
You're a big supporter. Absolutely. I love it.
Yeah.
What did you miss about Hempfest the last couple of years during the pandemic?
All of Hempfest?
Yeah.
Missed Hempfest.
Oh, me too,
exactly.
Man. I missed it too. That was an easy one. What is the next big thing Hempfest can help with the cannabis movement?
Well,
what can you do to help the cannabis movement?
Well, I'm always being very much of an advocate for
this. You're part of the panel?
Yeah, you've seen this kind of some of the activism that I'm interested in and trying to be involved in, and that is legalizing consumption lounges here in Washington State, legalizing home grows here in Washington State. So those are important issues. As far as Hempfest, you know, I think that it was amazing as a civil disobedience festival, and frankly, it still would be considering the fact that you cannot legally smoke outside here in Washington State. So it will continue as that role, and that's an important role, I think, to really push the limits of this.
Nice.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by the Hemp for Hunger Food Drive. Learn more about this event at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
Welcome back, and now we are on to our It's a Bus segment, and this is the part of the show where we talk about the war on drugs and specifically the war on cannabis. And this week, I didn't have to look far to find this story today. There's one of these every day, Dig. This is constant.
Yeah.
226 pounds of cannabis busted in Wyoming by State Patrol.
Oh, yeah.
It just baffles me, Dig. Of all the stuff going on in the world, I just don't understand how police can constantly, because like I said, every day, Nebraska, wherever, they're busting these big loads of cannabis. I don't know how police can pinpoint these people when there's all this other crime going on, but somehow they can find one car driving down the interstate with some weed in it.
Well, I think they pull over a lot of people in Wyoming. I think that's how they do it. They pull over a lot of people, and then they sniff around, and if they find something, they broadcast it. But I think it's bad luck for the driver. It's good luck for the cops. But I think a lot of why they target these big cannabis loads and why they get so excited when they find them is because the cops get to keep all that stuff. They get to keep the truck. They get to they get to keep the bales of cannabis. I don't know what they do with it. I assume they destroy it. Maybe they sell it. I don't know. There was a provision in some cannabis legalizations where if the cops seized illegal cannabis, they could turn around and sell it in dispensaries and stuff. They always find a way to make money off of an illicit crop when they seize it. But they can keep the truck, right? They can steal all the driver's money out of his bank accounts and keep it. They can do all that stuff because of how the Fourth Amendment's been interpreted. So I think that's why cops so zealously go after cannabis still. They like to find the large sums of cash they can steal from the cannabis growers, and they can keep that as off the book funds, and they don't have to report it the same way. I know that our local sheriff here in Jackson County, and the one up in Josephine County, stopped doing it as well. Once the federal people, the DEA, started getting involved in some of the cartel operation grows around here and seizing a lot of large sums of cannabis, they stopped reporting how much money they found to the press.
Mm.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we could do a whole show on It's a Bust, out of bust coming out of your neck of the woods there. They are constant and massive. Like Wyoming's 226 pounds. Oregon's like 75,000.
They just busted another. Like, so now it'll slow down, right? Because everybody's pretty much pulled in. It's cold. But in October, I swear, every week they were busting another, like, we were, like, plant counts that don't even seem real.
Yeah.
Lucas. Like, you're talking, I swear, the other 200,000 plants, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Crazy. You're talking, you go into a clearing, like, there's some land out there, and they'll have like six greenhouses on one plot of land. And then on the corner adjacent to that, and another plot of land, they'll have six greenhouses. So they'll have like four corner properties, and then all those corners meet, and then they'll have like an operation that crosses property line. It's wild. It's wild how they do it. Yeah, it's crazy. And I don't think it's a problem they're going to be able to fix in the short term. I think the only thing they may succeed in doing is driving the price of cannabis up short term in illegal states.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're – I mean, I have to assume – that some of these busts have done sizable damage to somebody's bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of these grows, I feel like, were the main effort. Like, they weren't busting decoy grows. They were, like, busting the main thing. Like, they were, and they were busting them right when they were, the sheriff department here has figured out the best time to bust them is in the middle of the summer when they're doing light deprivation, which is where they cover the greenhouses.
Yeah.
So the flowers bud in the middle of the summer. And then here and around in September and October, when you've got more workers coming in during flower and stuff. So that's when the big raids happen. And that's when they're most disruptive as well.
So as we mentioned back in our second story, the Leafly report, go check that out. All this going on in the midst of the sixth largest crop in the United States, $5 billion. They have cannabis companies trying to get on NASDAQ. There are people making big money out there, and the police are still out there arresting people for this, arresting people in Wyoming, Nebraska, all over the country. This is a constant trickle. Every day I'm getting these things. So we really need to end the war on cannabis just for so many reasons, but just common sense. I mean, how are you going to have the sixth largest crop in the country, but then if you grow it, too much of it, you're going to go to prison? It's just, it doesn't really add up. So let's continue to fight the war on drugs, and let's continue to keep doing this Cannabis Corner, Dig, because I really like talking to you on our show, and I really appreciate you being here today. And I want to thank the audience and KTQA, Radio Tacoma, everybody out there listening, all of our guests, everybody who has been there for the Cannabis Corner. And like I said, especially you, Dig, for making this our 50th episode. We're going to keep cruising along on this show. And I hope you have a good week, Dig.
Oh, I will. And I hope you do too. Hey, everyone out there, thanks for listening.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Foles for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.